turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins, which turns out to be the book of Exodus, or Shemot, chapter 13, about halfway through. And it's actually verse 17 in most of the English Bibles. As you know, when there are some other words like "and it came to pass," "ve yehi," and so forth, where the portion begins, you read the few extra words until you get something that's unique. A lot of times it'll say, "and Yahuwah spoke to Moshe saying," okay? And that one doesn't get the name either, because all the Torah portions that have the same name in that case. So in this case, it says, "Veyehi beshalak Pharaoh et ha'am." So it's beshalak, that is to send out, right? A shalak is the first phase of putting away. So Pharaoh literally kicked out what? Et? That's the pointer to the thing he kicked out. Ha'am, the people. And when that happened, it says, Yahuwah did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, which was basically the shortcut to the land. And the reason is because he said, lest peradventure the people groan or repent. And that word here is nacham in the Hebrew. Regret, maybe, is another way to put it. When they see war and decide to return to Egypt. Now, this is kind of interesting, and it's a subject of quite a bit of discussion. I always find, as you note, sometimes the insights that Rashi brings to the Hebrew kind of at least worth taking a look at. And in this case, there is, there's this concept that's laid out here. Why is it he's going to send them the long way? The shortcut via the Philistines on the coast there would be about a 50-day trip. As opposed to, well, it's going to take, let's say, a whole lot longer than that. Wouldn't normally have taken 40 years, even though that's how we know it's going to end up. But he's taken them the long way around. Take the long way home. Everybody's heard the old song. Because of the possibility of their seeing something. War is the term that's used here. And they groan about it. We're going to see a lot of that tonight. And they decide to return to Egypt. So he led them the long way around, by the wilderness, via the wilderness, by the Sea of Reeds. And the children of Israel went up armed out of the land of Egypt. Now, one other comment about this with respect to this idea of seeing war, because there's a whole lot of stuff in this week's Torah portion, including the fact that they're going to see some war. And yet that doesn't happen. Turns out the only time we really see him talking serious about returning to Mitzrayim is after the incident with the spies, which, doesn't really directly have to do with war. Yeah, they're concerned about it, it would seem. But it's kind of fascinating. So we see a number of places where there's war in this Torah portion. They don't whine. They whine about other things. And so, well, here I might part with a lot of the Midrash, I guess, and just suggest, you know, there's another possibility here, too. There are a whole lot of things that kind of have the psychological effect on us of seeing war. You know, you can even war within your own spirit. You can certainly have spiritual warfare. We're seeing a lot of that today. We're seeing people that literally make war on God in everything that they do and everything that they teach and want to force down people's throats and so forth. So it might be, in other words, that, and this is kind of the way I would suggest we might want to think about it, a broader understanding of this idea of war than just somebody coming at you with a sword. There are a lot of other ways to kill people and to literally hurt people and do major damage. So I can't help but think that's part of the implication here, given that we see things that you would think might have caused it that didn't, and other things that might not have that did. All right, so they're going to go the long way around by the Sea of Reeds. They went up armed. And Moshe, of course, this is something we've seen and was talked about back in Genesis, took the bones of Joseph with him. Because he had straightly sworn to the children of Israel, saying, he had sworn the children of Israel to it. In other words, Joseph had asked that this be done. Elohim will surely remember you. You shall carry my bones away with you when you go. So he knew what was going to happen. And this is another fulfillment of a prophecy and a promise. So they took their journey from Sukkot. They encamped in a place called Etam in the edge of the wilderness. Ha-Midbar, and Yahuwah went before them. Let's pause here for a second. We've heard this phrase. We're going to see it over and over again. In a pillar of cloud by day to lead them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light so that they could go whenever they needed to go, by both day and by night. Arguably, this is one of a number of miracles that are going to be shown to the B'nai Israel throughout this poor portion, and indeed throughout their journeys. So that leads me to kind of a thought process that I had as I was putting my notes together. Almost, well, I'll ask it as a question, right? You could almost hear it as a game show question, right? What was it, the old TV show, kind of a dorky thing? The Family Feud. Name a miracle. Right? If you ask 100 people in the studio audience, name a miracle, what are you going to hear? And I'm guessing the answer 9 times out of 10 is going to be, well, the parting of the Red Sea, right? That's the one. That's the one that when I was a kid, that was the big deal that we saw in the movie starring Charlton Heston as Moses. But of course, there are other ones in here too. And as I was writing all this down and thinking about it, and again putting my notes together, I couldn't help but think about the Taylor Motel Kamzoil. Everybody's seen Fiddler on the Roof. But of all God's miracles, large and small, the most miraculous one of all. He's singing it to his wife. He's going to get Tevye's oldest daughter. But he too talks about when God made the waters of the Red Sea part, that was a miracle. When God gave us manna in the wilderness. So many miracles, all of them from this Torah portion. Okay, well, chapter 14 says, Ve Yedibar Yahuwah al Moshe. And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and here's what he said. Speak to the B'nai Israel, and tell them to turn back and encamp before this place called Pi Hahirot, between Migdal and the sea, before Baal Zephon. Over against it, that's where you'll encamp, literally by the sea. He is setting a trap here. Pharaoh will then say of the B'nai Israel, they're entangled in the land. He'll think they're lost. In other words, he's probably got his spies watching them, seeing what's happening. And the wilderness has shut them in. So he believes he has them trapped, but the master of war is playing 11D chess with Pharaoh, and he's going to fall for it. I, Yahuwah says, will in fact make strong, kazakify. There's that terminology. I hope you don't find that too disgusting, but in any case, yeah, that root word, right, kazak, be strong and of good courage. It appears in this word here. What is going to happen to Pharaoh's heart? Pharaoh's already made his bed, and he is now going to follow through. He will in fact follow after them. I will get me honor upon Pharaoh, it says. So this is Yahuwah speaking, and upon all of his host. So upon Pharaoh, all of his host, and the Egyptians too, shall know what? Ki ani Yahuwah. And they did so. So the king of Egypt was told the people had taken off. The heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned towards the people, and they said, what have we done? Let these slaves, these people of Israel, go and not serve us anymore. Now, here's another one of the little interesting tidbits in the Hebrew, anyway. Another what you might call Rashiism. And it says, and he made ready his chariots, took his people with him. He, of course, what's the last he that we'd be referring to there? Well, that would be Pharaoh. But what's kind of interesting about this, and I do think it's a valuable insight, at least, is that normally you'd figure a man of Pharaoh's stature with his servants and all that kind of stuff would say, prepare the chariots, right? And they would make his chariot ready. It'd probably be all washed and waxed and ready to go. And he would simply go down and get in the chariot and head out. But no. The implication here and the claim is that he means literally he did exactly what the scripture says. He made it ready himself. He was chomping literally at the bit. The horses were chomping at the bit, but so was Pharaoh. He was anxious to go. He went down and did it himself. That's how, vile, complete, overwhelming was his preoccupation, his obsession. This was his great white whale, if you want to use that metaphor. He is ready to go. So he took his 600 chosen chariots, all the chariots of Egypt. He put all of his eggs right in that basket, captains over all of them. And now it says Yahuwah made strong. He kazaked the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, And he pursued after the B'nai Israel because they went out with a high hand. The Egyptians, all of them, all the horses, all the chariots, all the king's horses, all the king's men and his chariots, and his army overtook them, encamped there by the sea at the place that they were told to go, beside Pi-Hahiroth, in front of Baal Zephon. So Pharaoh comes close. The children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and you can almost see this, right? Holy moly! Look at over there. The entire army, the most powerful army in the entire world, is on the hillside, ready to come against us. They saw what was coming, and it says they were sore afraid. And what did they do? They cried out to Yahuwah. And furthermore, this is what I'm going to refer to as the first of the major whines of the children of Israel in the land. They whined, you can almost hear snowflakes, right, melting. No, that's modern stuff. Because there were no graves in Egypt, Mitzrayim, that's why you had to do this? Take us away to die out here? Good grief. Let's pause. I'm being a little bit hard on them. Not as hard as he's going to be later, but not as hard as perhaps they deserve. And yet, ultimately, the point is going to be made here in a number of ways. These people are literally, we just talked about it, they're seeing miracle after miracle after miracle. The miracles have only just begun. But they've come out of Egypt having been delivered by these plagues. They have seen things that literally no people on earth before have seen. You'd think they'd know better. Now, in their defense, yes, this is the most powerful army on planet Earth at the time. And I guess there's a natural tendency of people that think they're getting ready to die to have some fear. I can certainly understand that. But I do have a little bit of difficulty with the degree of whining, right? You brought us out here to die, they say to Moshe. Isn't this what we told you right back in when we were in Egypt, saying, let us alone? We'd like being good little slaves. For wasn't it better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die here in the wilderness? As I read this, I tend to think about a song, better to live, die on my feet than live on my knees is one of them. To die free men rather than to live slaves was the way Thomas Jefferson wrote it in a 1775 document that he put together on the necessity of taking up arms. In other words, there is a great mindset difference here between essentially the kinds of people who say, you know what, I appreciate what the Creator has done for me. I would rather die a free man rather than live a slave. And this is the opposite mentality. Moshe, though, this time lifts them up. And he offers what is, I will suggest, one of the most compelling and memorable and downright amazing, well, even prophetic understandings in the book. He said to the people, fear not, stand still and see Yeshuat Yahuwah. Literally here, see the salvation of Yahuwah. Stand still. Don't fear. Watch. You're going to be impressed by this. For the things that Yahuwah will do for you today. Now, of course, you know that this is the same root word and understanding that's associated with the Mashiach and the name that he was given. No, it was never Jesus. It was always the salvation of Yahuwah that was talked about. And here it is, Moshe, talking about specifically that. You watch, you see. The whole point of the story, right? Ki, Ani, Yahuwah. They will see it, an old baby. Fasten your seatbelts. Here we go. Furthermore, you've seen those Egyptians? Check out the hillside there. You'll see them today? You won't ever see them again after today. Yahuwah will fight for you. You all, just stand here and watch. So Yahuwah said unto Moshe, why are you crying out to me? Speak to the children of Israel. Tell them to go forward. Pull up the stakes, head them up, move them out. And lift up your rod, stretch it out over the sea of reeds in this case, and divide it. And the children of Israel will literally go into the midst of the sea on dry ground. Behold, he says, I'm going to continue to do what I've been doing. I will kazak, I will harden, strengthen the hearts of the Egyptians. They'll go right on in after him. And I will get me honor upon Pharaoh and on all of his host and upon his chariots and upon his horsemen. And the Egyptians, probably the last thing they will know, but they will know it. They will know, Ki Ani Yahuwah, that I am who I say I am, who I said I am, and who I will be. When I've gotten me honor upon Pharaoh, his chariots, and upon his horsemen. And the messenger, the malach of Yahuwah, who went before the camp of Israel, removed. Okay, so they basically see the pillar of fire move. The pillar of cloud, in this case, because it's daytime, removed from before them, and it stood behind them. So it's literally blocking the path at this point of the armies of Pharaoh. Came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel. There was the cloud and the darkness, and yet it gave light by night. So we have both, right? It's going to be there a while. One came not near the other all night. So he has kept the camps apart until the time for the great miracle that he is going to bring to pass. And Moshe, it says, stretched out his hand over the sea, and Yahuwah caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all night, and the sea became dry land, and the waters were divided. Now, this is one of those places where I'll probably talk about this in a little bit more detail tomorrow. Usually, I focus on it in quite a bit of depth. There is some midrash here that I've always found fascinating. There is a lot, in other words, that's in the text that if you actually picture it, right, think about what's going on, how long this would have taken, because we're talking about a period of overnight. Moshe has made the promise, but it's going to take a while for all of this to develop. And the Midrash, by the way, the claim, cannot prove this. This is extra biblical. So it's one of those things that I always suggest we take with a grain of salt. And yet, on the other hand, I do certainly think in this case, it kind of resonates with me. It has the ring of truth because we've already been told, right? Head them up, move them out. Why are you crying out to me, Yahuwah has already said to Moshe? Speak to the children of Israel that they go forward. But on the other hand, it's not going to be go forward yet because the sea hasn't been divided. So that happens. Moshe stretches out his rod, his hand, over the sea, and the east wind blows, and the sea parts. And we have waters on the left, waters on the right. Children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon dry ground. But how long did all that take? We know it took a while. So essentially the claim is that even though the waters weren't fully parted because it took a while, there were the intrepid leaders of Israel, and the Midrash even claims as to who these people were. But again, it's extra-biblical. I won't mention the names. But I do think the moral, at least, is consistent with this entire story. Kazakh, be strong and of good courage. See what I am going to do, and then move them out. And so the Midrash essentially says that the waters hadn't completely parted when it came time to move them out, and that the leadership basically marched on into the water anyway, knowing full well that if you take the first steps, he will in fact finish the job. So I like the concept in there anyway. Again, I don't build doctrine on it because I can't prove it, but it certainly does resonate with the theme of everything that's being taught here. The children of Israel went, though, eventually, all of them, into the midst of the sea on the dry ground. The waters were at this point a wall on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians eventually, when the cloud moved, were able to pursue. They went in after them into the midst of the sea, all of Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And it came to pass during the morning watch that Yahuwah looked forth upon the host of Egyptians through that pillar of fire and cloud. And he kind of had his way with them. He discomfited them is the way this is rendered into English. He literally bogged down their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily in the mucky, sandy, whatever the seabed is there. And they eventually decided, oh, we're in a whole heap of trouble here. We better flee from the face of Israel because guess who? They should have known, don't you think? But, that's what happens when your heart is externally hardened because you've made your bed, now you're going to lie in it or drown in it. It is Yahuwah that fights for them against the Egyptians. All right, then Moshe says to him, Stretch out your hand again over the sea, so that the waters will come back upon the people of Mitzrayim and their chariots and their horsemen. Moshe did so. He stretched forth his hand. The sea returned to its strength. When the morning appeared, the Egyptians fled against it, but they were overthrown in the midst of the sea. Waters returned, covered the chariots, the horsemen, and the entire host of Pharaoh that went in after them. Not so much as one of them survived. But, this is hearkening back to verse 22. This is, by the way, one of those little kind of a mini Atbash, right? Aleph, Tav, Beit Sheen, the first and last and second to first and second to last letters. In other words, nested brackets. You notice that it's almost an identical repeat. Verse 22 says, children of Israel went in the midst of the sea on dry ground. Here it is, verse 29. Children of Israel walked upon dry ground in the midst of the sea. And the waters again, on the right and on the left. It's a set of brackets setting off whatever it is of importance that's in the middle there. One of the greatest miracles, one of the kind of major miracles in Scripture, right? Name the miracle? Well, parting of the Red Sea, survey says, probably one of the most famous in the entire Scripture. And for that reason, it's also kind of interesting. I will mention this and probably talk about it. I certainly have talked about it many times in the past. I have a personal opinion about the way that the Creator seems to work His miracles, and I've called it for years the MNM, the Minimum Necessary Miracle. Sometimes the miracle that gets our attention is something that if we told somebody else, they may not even think it was a miracle, but we know better. Say, if you listen to the Taylor Motel Comsoil song in Fiddler on the Roof, well, that's a miracle. It's the greatest miracle he's ever seen. And it might not be as big of a miracle to people watching the movie or seeing the stage play, but it was more than necessary for Motel. And I think that's kind of the key of the miracles. It is sufficient to establish the purpose of the Creator. And sometimes it takes one that literally is of biblical proportions. And of those, this is one of the most famous. And what's also interesting, of course, about the minimum necessary miracle is it does depend to some extent on the eye of the beholder. These folks actually saw it. And we're going to talk about some other elements of it that are appropriate too. That's also kind of interesting. And yet, I'm sure I know, a lot of us, people that would say, oh, that didn't really happen, or, oh, it was just one of those natural things, right? It happened, probably happens all the time. That little land bridge just appears when we get a good wind. Who knows? But the point is, just about any miracle you can name, there will be skeptics, people who will say, that's not a miracle. And it does, and I've seen a number of midrashim on the topic. It does require someone to be willing to have eyes to see and to recognize the miracle for what it is. I look at the DNA double helix and single cell reproduction and so many other things and think, this is about as good of a proof of the existence of an intelligent designer, the Creator, as you're going to find. Oh, well, there's a miracle, but wait, right? The point is, it's here. It does demonstrate who He is. And yes, there will be those who will say, oh, it's just a natural event. Could have happened in other ways. You'll see the same thing, obviously, with the plagues. But there's this, that also, I think, especially if we kind of understand it from the perspective of the way it's listed in the Hebrew, that now begins to resonate just a bit more with that understanding. It says, thus, Yahuwah saved Israel. There's that word again. Shua root. Out of the hand of the Egyptians. And this is interesting. Why does this last sentence appear in here? Israel, it says, saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore. Well, the waters have covered them up. They're going to drown. Is that really that surprising? Yeah. It is in context. Now think about this. Here are people that not even a chapter ago were whining about, oh, we'd rather die here in the wilderness. Let's go be slaves again. And the very next day, Moshe's told them, you won't see them again after this. Well, here's the after part that's going to be the last time they see them. They saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore. Now, I do like the commentaries here, too. The fact that this is put in here this way kind of suggests that there is something personal going on. In other words, with this idea of the miracle, yeah, you just saw the Red Sea parted. You know what? The miracle ain't done yet. Remember that nasty taskmaster that was oppressing you personally? Well, when you see his bloated corpse floating on the seashore there, it resonates. I'm not a slave anymore. That guy's dead, and there lies his bloated corpse. In other words, the implication, can't prove this either, but I do like the concept. Israel saw the Egyptians dead. They recognized, they saw it. They saw it in whatever way they needed to see it to make the point. They were fully free. This is literally exactly what they were promised. The salvation of Yahuwah. Yeshuat Yahuwah. And that's how the chapter ends. Israel saw the great work which Yahuwah did upon the Egyptians, and the people, Yare, that word there, feared. It's a respectful fear. It's an awe, if you will. They feared Yahuwah. And they believed Yahuwah too. And they believed Moshe. It's not enough, in other words, and in English, the root words, sometimes we put a little different meanings on them. I usually explain it in the English this way. It's one thing to believe that there is a God, believe in Him, and it's another thing to believe Him. You understand what I'm saying? It's one thing to say, well, even the demons believe. That's not such a big deal. It's another thing to say, no, I believe Him to the point where I will do what He says. On the one hand, I know that He exists. All right, good, big deal. On the other hand, I know that He is who He says He is, and I'll walk in obedience because I know that I can trust Him. And the same thing goes for Moshe. They believed His servant Moshe too. So when it's all said and done, what we're talking about here is escape and overcome and then have it resonate. See it. It's a done deal. And now we're seeing this idea of Yareh, an awesome fear of Yahuwah, and they don't just believe in Him, they believe Him. Chapter 15, of course, we already just sang the song earlier. May not be the same song, but it's at least one of the two places where there is a song. Sometimes this is called the Song of the Sea, but this is the Song of Moses about the sea. And chapter 15 is literally the song. It says, basically, Moshe sang, and the children of Israel sang this song unto Yahuwah. And they spoke the following, I will sing unto Yahuwah, for He is highly exalted, the horse and his rider. He's thrown into the sea. Yahuwah is my strength and my song. He has become Li Yeshua, my salvation. This is my Elohim. I will glorify Him. He's my Father's Elohim. I will exalt Him. And then there's this, too. I always kind of get a kick out of this. Another Rashi commentary. But it's not just an Ish, is the Hebrew understanding. It says, Yahuwah Ish Milchama. He is an Ish of war, a man of war. But in this case, the implication he suggests, and I think it's precisely correct, is a lot stronger than that. He ain't just a man of war. He is the master of war. The man, we would say in English. He's not just a man. He is the man of war. Yahuwah is His name. And I use the analogy at this point of saying, for those of us that grew up playing chess, there is a terminology, right? The real master is, in fact, the chess master. Sometimes you even hear him called the grand master. These are people that, when it comes to playing on the board of war, 64 square, are masters of war. And that's what's being described here. Song goes back and says, Pharaoh's chariots and his host he cast into the sea. His chosen captains are sunk in the sea of reeds. They are covered by the depths. They went down into the depths like a stone. Thy right hand, O Yahuwah, glorious in power, thy right hand dashes in pieces the enemy and the greatness of your excellency. You have overthrown them, all that rise up against you. You send forth your wrath, it consumed them like stubble. And with the blast of your nostrils, the waters were piled up, stood upright like a heap. The depths were congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, well, the four eyes here. Let's see. One, two. Yeah, it depends on how you count them. My lust shall be satisfied. But in any case, there is a kind of a standard understanding. Yahuwah gave his eyes the things that he is going to do. And this is the enemy, if you will, the adversary, that's got his own four eyes. Turns out he's wrong. I will pursue. I will overtake. I will divide the soil. My lust shall be satisfied upon them. I will draw my sword, and my hand shall destroy them. Nope, not quite. Instead, you blew with your wind. The sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. And here we have another one. This is the words in the Hebrew of a song that we did this evening too. And I always like this. Mika Moka Belim Yahuwah. Who is like you, O Yahuwah, among the mighty ones? Who is like unto you? Glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders. You stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed them. In your love, you led the people that you have now redeemed. You've guided them in your strength to your set-apart place, your holy habitation. Peoples have heard. They tremble. Pangs have taken hold on the inhabitants of Philistia. In other words, word is spreading here about this. Then there were the chiefs of Edom. They were scared too. Mighty men of Moab, trembling, took a hold on them. The inhabitants of Canaan literally melted away in fear. Terror and dread falls upon them because the greatness of your arm, well, it makes them literally freeze like stone. Till your people pass over, O Yahuwah, till they pass over that you've gotten. Bring them in. Plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, the place, O Yahuwah, which you've made. For you to dwell in the sanctuary, O Yahuwah, that your hands have established. Yahuwah shall reign forever and ever. More about the horses of chariot. They went in. The Lord, Yahuwah. The King James, of course, keeps translating that YHVH, the Yod Heh Vav Heh in the Hebrew, as capital L-O-R-D. And I generally try to read it the way it should be. Yahuwah brought back the waters of the sea upon them, but the children of Israel walked on dry land. And here we're going to see the first reference to somebody by name that we've already heard talk about, but we never are, up until this point, told her name. I think this is, that's what, yeah. This woman at this point, and she is a little older than Moshe. Remember, he's 80 years old. She's getting up there. She's probably about 6 years older than he is. But her name, Miriam. And in this place, not only is her name given, but she is referred to as the prophetess, sister of Aaron. Think about that, too. She's Moshe's sister, but in this place, she's described as a prophetess and the sister of Aaron. Huh. Well, at the point where she did her first and most famous work prior to all of this, Moshe was just a little baby. So, you know, at that point, she had known her her older brother, but not the one that was going to be put into the Nile River and float away in the ark. So anyway, Miriam the prophetess, sister of Aaron, took a timbrel in her hand. All the women went out with her, and they danced. And Miriam sang unto them. And here's what she sang. Sing ye unto Yahuwah, for he is highly exalted. The horse and his rider he's thrown in the sea. We're going to see this metaphor over and over, and probably not even a metaphor, that literally Miriam sang and danced before Yahuwah. And this seems to be a vital impact and mission that she had during this period of time in the wilderness. So Moshe led Israel onward from the Red Sea. They went out into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days into the wilderness, and now there is no water. This place, of course, is called Bitterness. In the Hebrew, it's Marah. And they couldn't drink the bitter waters in the place of bitterness. Because they were, yeah, Marah. So guess what they called the name of the place? Well, we know. It's Marah. People murmured against Moshe. Gee, this is becoming a familiar refrain already. And we're just barely, getting into the first of the whining Torah portions. And they said to Moshe, what shall we drink? We're thirsty. So he cried out to Yahuwah, and he was shown a tree. cast it into the waters. That made the waters sweet, drinkable. And there it says he made for them two things, a hook and a mishpat, statute and an ordinance. Two elements of what we would call law, but a statute and an ordinance. And there he tested them. Now remember, the definition of a hook, right? A hook is one of these things in the Hebrew language. It gets translated as a statute, but I think it's more important to understand. A hook is do it because I said so. You might be able to take a look at a mitzvot or a mishpat, you know, the other commandments and things to do, and say, okay, I can understand why. If I don't want to be killed, it's good not to kill. If I don't want to be stolen from, it's good not to steal. Or other various things make sense. But a hook is, by definition, just kind of one of those things that we may not understand why, but just do it. The question then comes up, which ones are we talking about here? A statute and an ordinance. And there are some suggestions. I think the one that's probably the easiest to understand is the Sabbath. A lot of folks will say, well, when you talk about a hook in Scripture, kind of the quintessential hook is the red heifer, so maybe that could be what he's talking about. But there is enough indication that it is the Sabbath, because when we see later the references to the Sabbath, we're going to get the understanding, hey, I've already told you about this. And indeed, it's going to show up here too. So it does make sense to me that one of these two things is the ordinance of the Sabbath. And then he said this, if you'll diligently hearken, shamar, hear and obey, the voice of Yahuwah your El, and you'll do that which is right in his eyes, and give ear to his commandments, mitzvotim, and you keep all of his statutes, his hukin, then I will put none of the diseases upon you that I poured out on the Egyptians. Why? Ki ani Yahuwah. And in this case, we've heard the term, right? Yahuwah Rapha, Yahuwah the healer. And this is actually Rofeka. I am Yahuwah who does heal you, if you will. It's a verb tense. But it's the same terminology we're going to see, the name Yahuwah Rapha, Yahuwah the healer. They came to Elim, there were 12 springs of water, and 70 70 palm trees, and encamped there by the water. So, they took their journey from Elim, and Kol Idat, all of the congregation of the children of Israel, came into the wilderness of Sin, in this case, Midbar Sin, between Elim and Sinai, and they did so on the 15th day of the second month. Okay, 15th day of the first month is the time that we know now as the Passover. That's the time when they left. So this is a month later. And it's also going to be the time, of course, of the second Passover. That's the one that will be established for those that, for whatever reason, weren't able to do what was necessary the first time around. And the whole congregation, Kol Idat, of the children of Israel, what, again? Murmured against Moshe and against Aaron, Bamidbar, out there in the wilderness. They're going to whine. What are they going to say? Well, this sounds painfully familiar. The children of Israel said to those two leaders, wish we had died by the hand of Yahuwah in Mitzrayim. We sat there by the flesh pots. Oh, we had lots of bread. And here you brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Yahuwah is very long-suffering. He is patient at this point. He says to Moshe, look, I will now cause bread to rain down from heaven for you. People will go out and they'll gather a day's portion on every single day, and that I can test them, see whether or not they will walk in my Torah, my Torah, or not, my instruction, or not. And it'll come to pass on the sixth day. Now, this is one of several reasons why it's suggested that when he said he gave them a statute and an ordinance, that at least one of them had to do with the Sabbath. Because now we're going to see it just a few verses later. I'll see. It'll come to pass on the sixth day, they'll prepare that which they bring in, right? They can bake it, fry it, put it in a deep fat fryer. They can do all kinds of things with this stuff, this bread from heaven. But on the sixth day, they're going to get twice as much of it to do with whatever it is they're going to do as they get regularly. So Moshe and Aaron, why, right? Oh, well, we know, but they're going to find out. Moshe and Aaron then said to the children of Israel, if they haven't already, at evening you'll know what Yahuwah has brought you out from the land of Egypt. He has done this. And in the morning, you'll see the glory of Yahuwah, for he has heard your murmurings against Yahuwah. And who are we that you murmur against us? Moshe then continued, and he said, this shall be when Yahuwah gives you in the evening flesh to eat, and the morning bread to the full, because he has heard your whining, your murmurings, and you murmur against him. Again, what are we? You're not murmuring against us, but you are in fact murmuring against him. So Moshe says to his brother Aaron, say to all of the congregation of the children of Israel, again, Kol Edat, of the B'nai Israel, come near before Yahuwah. He has been listening. He's heard your whining. And it came to pass, as Aaron spoke unto the entire congregation of the children of Israel, they looked up towards the wilderness, and behold, the glory of Yahuwah literally appeared in the cloud. And he said the following, I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel. Speak to them and say the following, at dusk you'll eat flesh, and in the mornings you'll be filled with bread, and you shall know what? Again, right? Ki ani Yahuwah. And in this case, it's Ki ani Yahuwah Elohekim, your El. So it came to pass that evening, here come the quails. They covered the camp. Morning, there was a layer of dew round about the camp. And when the layer of dew was gone up, on the face of the wilderness was a fine scale-like hoarfrost-looking kind of stuff. A nice a little fluffy white powder everywhere. When the children of Israel saw it, they asked one another, Mon? Mon? What? What? They didn't know what it was, so they're asking the question. Mon is the Hebrew word, means what? And says, Moshe, it is ha-lechem, the bread which Yahuwah has given you to eat. By the way, the first time we see this word in Scripture, Mon, what? What is it? Is right here in verse 15 of this chapter. You already know where I'm headed, right? Mana? Guess what? What is it? Becomes the name. What is it? Well, this is what it is. It is what it is. What is it? This is the thing which Yahuwah has commanded, though. Gather it. Get as much as each man wants. An omer ahead. According to how many folks you got to feed, that's what you're to take. Every man for those that are in his tent. So basically, you're going to go out and you're going to gather enough for all the folks in your tent. Children of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. The hungry ones, right, got a little bit more. When they did, they meted it out with an omer. However much they got, in other words, he that gathered much had nothing left over. The guy who was just gathered a little less didn't have any lack. Each man gathered according to his eating. Moshe commanded them, though, and said, look, be careful. Do not leave any of it until the morning. Now, there's usually some that aren't going to listen, right? So a few didn't hearken to Moshe. Some of them left it until the morning, and it became wormy, literally full of worms, and it rotted. Moshe was upset with them. Look, I told you not to do that. Now you know. They gathered it morning by morning, each man according to his eating, and as the sun waxed hot, it melted. So if you didn't get it, it didn't stay. Came to pass on the sixth day, exactly as they were told, they got twice as much bread, two omers for each person in the house, and all the rulers of the congregation came and they told Moshe. And here's what he said to them. This is that which Yahuwah has spoken. So here we are. This is before Sinai. He's already given them a statute and an ordinance. And this is part of the reason why some suggest, and I tend to think it's a pretty good case, that the Sabbath was one of these things. Tomorrow, he says, is a day of solemn rest. A holy, a set-apart Shabbat unto Yahuwah. Bake the things you're going to need to bake. Seethe that which you seethe. Anything that lays up for you overnight, well, this time, you can, in fact, keep it until the morning, as commanded. Because this is a whole different night. It's literally a different miracle that's going to make that point. Moshe said, eat that today. When they woke up, no worms in it. Looks pretty good. Today is a Sabbath unto Yahuwah, he said. You're not going to find any more in the field. Know this. 6 days you gathered. Seventh day is a Sabbath. There won't be any, and indeed there wasn't. Came to pass on the seventh day. Some of them went out anyway. Check it out. And they didn't find any. So at this point, Yahuwah then asks Moshe kind of the key question. How long, for crying out loud, are you going to refuse to keep my mitzvot, my commandments, and Torah T, my instructions? See that Yahuwah has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you on the sixth day enough for 2 days. Hang out. Stay home. Don't go out on your place looking for more on the seventh day. So the people did finally get it, and they rested on the seventh day. And the house of Israel called the name of this new stuff manna. It was kind of like coriander seed, white. Taste of it was like wafers made with honey. So they literally named it basically, what is it? Moshe said, this is what it is. This is the thing which Yahuwah has commanded. Let an omer full of it be kept throughout your generations. So literally, it's going to be gathered up. It's going to be put in the Ark of the Covenant. And what do you bet? This one doesn't get wormy. It's going to hang and be available for a long, long time. So that future generations can see, literally, this what is it that you were fed in the wilderness when I brought you out from the land of Egypt. So Moshe told Aaron, do that. Take a jar, put an omer full in this in the jar, lay it up before Yahuwah to be kept throughout your generations. So, as Yahuwah commanded Moshe, Aaron did so before the testimony to be kept. And it says the children of Israel did this. They ate this manna for 40 years till they came to the place where they were eventually headed, the inhabited land. They ate the manna until they came to the borders of the land of Canaan. And then it tells us something that I've always found kind of, well, interesting, almost out of place. How big is an omer? Well, an omer is a tenth part of an ephah. Can't help but think there's more to it. And perhaps one of these days we'll know. Okay, chapter 17. The children of Israel journeyed from the wilderness of Sin by their stages, according to the commandment of Yahuwah. Next place they go is Rephidim, where again, there's no water. So again, they strive with Moses, give us water, give us water. And he says, look, why are you doing this again? Why do you test Yahuwah? Well, they were thirsty, and they, of course, murmured, they whined, and they spoke against Moshe, and they said, right, can you fill it in right by now? Why, oh, why have you brought us up out of Mitzrayim to kill us here in this horrible wilderness with thirst? Oh, and our cattle, too. And your mangy little dog, too. Who knows? All of it, right? Yahuwah basically hears Moshe at this point cry out. Say, what am I going to do with this people? They're almost ready to stone me. Well, says Yahuwah unto Moshe, pass before the people. Get yourself with the elders. Take your rod, the one that you smote the river, take it in your hand and go. Behold, I will stand before you on the rock there in Horeb. And you are to, now this is going to be very, very important. Because as we know, having read the end of this particular story, later on, he's going to do this again because it worked before without paying attention to the specific instructions. And it turns out it matters a lot. Going to go smite the rock, he says. This time, yep, that is what you're going to do. You're going to whack the rock with your stick, with your rod. There will then come out of it lots and lots of water. You got millions of people to feed here in the wilderness. You can imagine this is going to be a major water flow coming out of this rock so that the people may drink. So Moshe did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. The name of that place they called Massah and Meribah because of the striving of the children of Israel, because they tried Yahuwah, asking, look, is he literally here before us or not? And it's interesting what the very next verse says. Then came Amalek. Of all the biblical enemies that are described, Amalek is certainly one of the most insidious. The one that Yahuwah is going to tell us he will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. But remember what we talked about up front here? When the people see war, maybe they'll get scared and want to go back the short way, so they're not going to go the short way. to Mitzrayim? It's not going to happen here. Amalek comes, fought with Israel in Rephidim, and he, Moshe, says to his number two man, his lieutenant, Joshua, go get some men, go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I'll stand up on top of the hill there with the rod of Elohim in my hand. So Joshua did as Moshe said. He went out and he fought with Amalek. Meanwhile, you got Moshe, Aaron, and Hur up on top of the hill, basically overlooking the battle. And it came to pass that whenever Moshe held up his hand with the staff in it, of course, Israel prevailed. When he let down his hand, Amalek takes the lead. But after a while, you can imagine holding your arms up, especially with a staff, gets pretty hard. His hands got heavy. So what they do first? They took a stone. They put it under him so he could sit down, so he didn't have to keep standing up so that they can prevail in the battle. Meanwhile, you got Moshe with one man on one side, Aaron on one side, Hur on the other side, and they held up his hands so that he could stay steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua, well, proverbially kicked butt and took names, discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge, lefi cherem, a cherev, the sword, with the mouth, literally, of the sword. The mouth of the sword devours blood, spills it on the ground. Yahuwah then said to Moshe, write this down, put it in the book, rehearse it in the ears of Yahushua, for I am utterly going to blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Interestingly, it hasn't quite happened yet, but it will. So Moshe built an altar. He names it. Now, and a lot of times this translation says Adonai Nisi. It's actually Yahuwah Nisi. Yahuwah Nisi. After the place where Moshe held up his hands holding the staff. Literal translation is Yahuwah, my banner. My banner. My standard bearer. My banner. Something that is, in fact, lifted up. And this takes us to the end of the Parsha. Because then he said, the hand upon the throne of Yahuwah. Yahuwah will, in fact, have war with Amalek from generation to generation. And that takes us to the end of the portion, again, where there are perhaps more miracles per meter here than in any other portion in Scripture. And it's always, well, in a way, it's, as you can guess from the tone of my voice on occasion here, it's almost irritating that it's also more whining than we see in most other portions. Not that there's not sufficient whining to go around in other places coming up over the next 40 years, but it's almost like the bigger the miracles, the more whining we get. And somehow or other, I can't help but think that that's got something to do with the human condition. And it's certainly a caution to us as well. Again, you would think that having seen these kind of miracles, people would, in fact, recognize what? Ki ani Yahuwah. And by the same token, they didn't really see this battle as being as dramatic as the prophecy might have suggested. You were saying, oh, when they see battle, they'll want to head back. Well, this battle wasn't that big of a deal. Obviously, they prevailed. That's not the scary stuff. So again, the scary stuff is something else, and the scary stuff probably somehow is related to the whining too. We'll continue to think about and talk about this. Of all of the things that kind of resonate with me as I look out to the future and ask the question, what do we got coming, right? What are we going to see? We know that there is a greater Exodus prophesied, and I pray and believe that we will see that one way or another. And I also understand that given what they saw, there is a real caution here too that we need to be aware of and prayerfully trying to deal with so that when the time comes, we can avoid the temptation to whine and not understand the miracles when they happen right before us.